And I am representing Heritage Ricker Housing and Jobs Coalition, which is a group of about 40 owners of multifamily and also commercial buildings. And the owners of those buildings, I think, who we represent, would like to do the right things in terms of protecting their residents and also saving their buildings. As was said, you know, the buildings have character and people bought them really because they love the buildings. But it's very difficult to do the kind of upgrades to protect the buildings without some real financial tools to make them feasible. Brickers are a very important source of reasonably priced housing. And if you compare the cost of so many of the unreinforced or partially reinforced apartments to new apartments, you'll see that they're significantly, maybe 50% less. And so the concern is that unless there are some real tools to help owners, that what's going to happen to the buildings is that people, I'm sure, will try and raise the rents, but as was mentioned earlier, they're not the kind of upgrades that you can just expect people to pay significantly more rents. They're not, you know, new appliances, new hardwood floors. Residents are, at this point, just not clued in to the fact that, you know, it is important to have a seismically safe building. These buildings also certainly add to the city's heritage, and the commercial buildings often house much of the creative community, software companies, designers, media companies, and the cost of upgrading, you know, there are figures certainly that are all over the place, but for most owners, it's just not financially feasible. And with costs starting at maybe $500,000 for a 40,000 square foot building, and really not being able to recoup any of that in the rent and remain competitive in the rental market, you know, the owners have, you know, very limited choices. You know, as I mentioned, their ability to increase rents, you know, residents are really not going to pay significantly more for that. So they're not, they'll certainly increase them to the extent that they can, and it will have an effect on increasing rent some, but certainly the full cost can't be passed through. They can sell to a developer, and I think that given what's happening with Portland's real estate market right now, that that's really a viable possibility, because lots, when lots of 50 by 100 lot zoned RH is selling in Northwest Portland for $1 million, and somebody's looking at having to put, you know, $500,000, $1 million into, you know, let's say a 30 to 40 unit building, the economics of it just really don't pencil out. And so I think that if you're interested in preserving affordable housing, which I know you are, that trying to, you know, figure out some way that owners have some real financial incentive, and something that's really meaningful, not just, you know, a token gesture, you know, would be the way to go about that. You had, I think, asked about financing and how the buildings are financed, and basically there are lenders that will loan on those buildings, but it's a restricted choice of lenders. And so that's one problem, too. If you want to go out and get a loan for upgrading your unreinforced masonry building, you know, Chase, for example, who's the largest apartment lender in this area, they won't do it. You know, there are some other lenders, you know, Washington Federal and a handful of others, but they are going to be doing a typically a lower loan to value, and it's going to be at a higher interest rate. You know, it's all just a balance between risk and their return. So there really are not very many.
I don't understand why the bank cares to lend for that versus lending for the hardwood floors.
Oh, okay. That's a very good question. With hardwood floors, you can get more rent. So if you're doing, improvements in your unit or even in your common areas, you know, your residents will pay more, or, you know, your commercial residents, if you're upgrading their individual offices, doing tenant improvements. And so the bank is going to look at the income, and then they're going to want to make sure that, you know, the debt service is more than adequate to cover the income. You know, they look at a debt coverage ratio. And so if you're having basically the same rents, but you're having a lot more debt on it, then, you know, from their perspective, it doesn't underwrite as well.
If you've already paid off your building, then all of your rent is coming in over the expenses of the building.
Right. Well, most people do not own these buildings free and clear. You know, there's just a handful of lucky owners who are in that position, but, you know, very few of the people in our group, unfortunately, we'd love to, you know, have no debt on our buildings.
So they've changed hands in the last 30 years?
Typically, yes.
Liz, do you have an idea of how many people live in unreinforced masonry buildings? Do we have an idea?
I know that within the central city, the statistics that I think Walt McMoney has gathered for us, that there are at least 10,000 people in apartments. And I really don't know in terms of, you know, some of the creative office spaces and the commercial buildings. But I would think it'd be a lot.
Sure. So Gwen Baldwin, also representing Heritage Brickers. And again, Walt is unfortunately out of the country. But one of the things that's been talked about and referred to was the upgrade that he did at the Trinity Place apartments. And, you know, if here, why not everywhere? What are the sort of lessons to be learned from the upgrades that were done? So I wanted to take the opportunity and give you sort of a rundown of what the differentiators are, what worked and what doesn't work for others, and some of the sort of looking forward. And I, you know, I want to preface this by reiterating something that Liz touched on, which is of the statistics that were put out in terms of buildings that were seismically retrofitted or demolished. I don't think anybody wants demolished to be the option taken. And so what we're really talking about is how do we tease out and identify the ways to jump over those financial barriers, not ignore the situation or not sort of jam something through, but this is really about a financial barrier system. How do we get from one side to the other in a way that preserves this amazing stock and is viable? Because the alternative exists out there, and it's not one that I think any of us want. So back to Trinity Place. It's a 36-unit historic apartment building in Northwest. It cost just about $500,000 to do the retrofits. And that was a basic, simple life safety. So it was tie-ins to the walls. It was completed over 2 years, largely as the units turned over. And that was important for cash flow, and it was also important to maintain a relationship with the tenants, some of whom were very long-term. But of our group, I will tell you, that's the only multifamily that we know that's been done. All these other retrofits that we're talking about are commercial. So it's a very complicated thing. So why did it work? Well, one, Trinity was on a special assessment under ORS 358, so it had significant property tax savings.
Because it was historic?
It was historic. Yeah. Two, there was a low basis in the Trinity, and therefore it could qualify for some of the historic federal historic rehab credits. If you don't have a low basis, they're not going to extend that credit to you. It's that loan-to-value ratio, so you're basically not heavily leveraged. You've got something to go for. Upfront funds for the upgrade came from refinancing other apartment buildings. So he had other apartment buildings to do the refinancing and then draw those resources for that provided some of the upfront cash.
So it wasn't depending on equity from that building.
No.
Value from that building.
No. Correct. Not a lot of folks have that kind of. Exactly. Exactly. And so I think there's really, I think, some positive things that come from this example, but I think it would be really not useful to kind of go, oh, this can be duplicated everywhere. It's a pretty significant harmonic convergence of the finances. The other things that helped, the building, the floor diaphragms were stiff enough so that they didn't have to be upgraded. The soil under the Trinity was deemed by a geologist, a geotech person, as having compacted, so the foundation work wasn't needed. That really lowered the cost. Of the 36 units, 28 were retrofitted on turnover after tenants gave 30-day notices. But in year two, the tenants were given sort of 60-day end-of-tenancy notices to move so the work can be completed, because there were longer-term tenants. We were dealing with the roof and that sort of tie-ins there. It needed, you know, we sort of had to go to that place. So again, the idea that this could entirely be done on turnover would have to either be a very, very long proposition, or the recognition that there was going to be upheaval in tenancies. But as a general rule, the desire was to try to have people transfer to other units as they got done. So it also was, there's a human factor of incredible combination of the management team for the building, the contractors who were coming in. Literally, I mean, they get the call, it would be come in, crack open the ceiling, do the tie-ins, have historic plaster, get it back on. You know, I mean, this was pretty significant choreography. Also credit to BDS. There was a lot of flexibility in the engineer on the design for that building. Really worked to try to accomplish, be sensitive to the timing around that. And, you know, that always helps. So again, the contractor Pioneer Waterproofing, KBC Management, hugely important combination. So what's atypical? Why isn't this something that can be done everywhere? One, most do not have the same financial position. Refinancing funds up front, the historic status of Trinity Place, the subsequent frozen properties, and the ability to complete the upgrades over a number of years as units turn in order to maintain cash flow. Not every owner has the ability to forego cash flow, even if they could figure out the other pieces and add to the property's debt, especially when the upgrades, as Liz said, don't provide a payback in the form of increased rents. I think the payback on this is something like 25 or more years. So commercial buildings, I think as Doug said, Andy said earlier, commercial buildings are less likely to have tenants that turn regularly. Many have long-term leases. So how that gets done, again, is a much more complicated prospect. And not all owners have a basis low enough to qualify for those federal tax credits. So I think the concern is, what is the right combination that creates the jump over the financial barriers? Because creating a strict schedule doesn't change that. Those things have to go hand in glove. The desire to get to a seismic retrofitting has to come with a mechanism to jump the financial hurdles. And I really appreciated the list of possible solutions, because I really do think, and some of them are things that we've raised in the past, and so that's also, I think, it speaks to a good partnership in the making. There's not going to be one tool that fixes it. This can't just be solved by, TIF. This can't just be solved by assuming people can do this on cash flow, or consuming that tax credits of one type or another are all available. But they're all important to the mix. So I think we are looking at, let's pilot before committing. Nobody wants to have a system set up that is unusable. With the Old Town Chinatown budget that TIF dollars do provide at least a pool to pilot. And then let's look at some of the other things. Social benefit bonding, like PACE. I know that's being discussed. Jules Bailey is obviously a big champion of that in the legislature. There's an opportunity to look at maybe expanding from property-assessed clean energy, PACE means, to look at extending it to cover seismic retrofits, as it's been done elsewhere, along with water conservation. So if you get something where you can bond, you get the resources to do it up front, those savings that come from lower insurance costs, better ability to refinance at a lower rate, can help repay so that, again, the hurdle is jumped. That's the key thing. State income tax credit, I know that's being discussed, and we're obviously very eager to see that happen. Again, as part of the mix, not everybody's going to be able to qualify for those abatements, and then also, again, holding up on the other upgrades if seismic is being done, so that becomes a priority. And so I think our group is very, very interested in continuing this conversation and being involved in trying to make something that works. I think all of us want to get to the other side where we have those kind of seismic upgrades. And it's not because the majority of buildings came down, either by a shake or by redevelopment.
So we saw in the presentation that San Francisco and I think it was Los Angeles have mandatory upgrade requirements. I mean, how are those cities doing that, and the world isn't ending for residential property owners?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of the fact that California has such significant quakes. I mean, it's constant, it's frequent. And so the dynamic, both in terms of education, in terms of the finances, in terms of what insurance looks like, in terms of how banks lend, all those things are a slightly different dynamic. I mean, I think the comparison that I think Peter and other people make.
Are banks actively engaged in the lending process down there than as opposed to the more limited participation that Liz just described up here? Or is that something you don't know?
I don't know. All the details, but I think that that's something that, again, we should explore. But I think part of this is that California is a different universe, both in terms of how seismic is viewed, what they've experienced, the number of quakes, the amount of damage. It just creates a different market, small M and big M. And that conversation about the sort of lead, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, all the work that you've done and other members of council at the time when it was really nascent, that didn't have any particular market marquee. But over the course of time, it has. And I think that, you know, looking at it from a positive sense of, you know, standing strong placard has, you know, I think could over the course of time have that same kind of market push. But it is a time consideration. And so rather than wait for market forces in a separate unrelated way, I think spending some time on the how do you jump the barrier is a worthwhile endeavor for all of us.
Have you in your group thought about are there the bonding idea is a good one, but pooling risk, pooling resources through some kind of mechanism, public or private? I mean, there are, we've got a bunch of buildings in roughly similar situations that are not in the situation that the Trinity building was in, where single owners with a single financed building that they can't finance the seismic improvements to. Have you talked about or brainstormed about ways to sort of pool the risk and pool the cost?
That's a very good question. We're trying to do that now as far as insurance, because really the only insurance is, you know, Lloyd's of London, and it's very expensive. And so doing that as a group hopefully will be more affordable than, you know, doing it as individuals. Mm-hmm. One thing I just wanted to mention, too, that I should have said is that in our group we have a lot of smaller owners. And so I think a lot of those people, I mean, they're very successful, but quite honestly, they're living off their cash flow and they want to be responsible owners, but they don't have a $1 million line of credit that they can just go to for these things.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of follow up, a couple things. One, obviously, some kind of working group between the folks that own these buildings and the relevant city bureaus, and they're all here, or many of them are here, certainly BDS. Emergency plant management and PDC are all in the mix. And then, you know, we are actually meeting this week to begin sketching out what our legislative wish list and agenda is for next session. So if state legislation is necessary, you know, one way or another, whether it's on the regulatory side or on the incentive side, you know, this would be a good time to start that discussion as well. And know what our collective ask is. And then thirdly, I think just engaging the smart people in the financial world about how do we, you know, what public-private mechanisms can be created, particularly since now we have earmarked a certain percentage or portion of our funds in Old Town Chinatown specifically for this work. How do we leverage that? How do we work with financial institutions to get as many buildings fixed as possible with a given dollar amount of public funds in whatever form it comes, subsidy or appropriation? You know, I think all those discussions, this is a, you know, as you described it very well, it's a really complex issue. And there are other parties, namely insurance and finance, in addition to the building owners and the city, that have to be engaged, I think, to get to a formula that works.
Can I make one comment, too? Commissioner Fred said, I ask, I thought a good question, you know, why is this different than imposing, say, ADA standards? And I think one difference is, you know, ADA applies to all new construction, and you build it into your construction financing. So it's just part of the project cost up front, as opposed to something afterward where you're trying to retrofit it, figure out how to finance it, you're trying to compete with other buildings that, you know, and still be competitive in your rents.
The other thing I would, is that my understanding is that Seattle is struggling with this very issue. They had, a very robust discussion. Really great work. Stakeholders came up with a package of proposals, and one of which was to identify the right sort of financial mechanisms. And my understanding is that that's been an area that they have been a little hung up on. They're not sure they've got the right package. They're not sure they got the right tools. So it just bears note that perhaps we can find the, you know, a better way.
Are you in touch with your peers in Seattle?
Some.
Obviously, we should.
Yeah.
We're in touch with our peers in San Francisco and have been learning about what techniques have been working and not working on both sides.
Yeah.
But I think it will be helpful for all of us to be in touch with our respective peers in the various cities, because, I mean, we know what the regulators in San Francisco did, but it would be helpful to have a longer conversation with you guys about what the owners in San Francisco did and how was it possible that the sky didn't fall, or maybe for some people, some of the owners, it did.
I know that Walt McMoney's, you know, if he was here, he could address that more knowledgeably, because I know he certainly has looked into, you know, what's been going on in Seattle and some other areas and some other models. And we do actually, several of the people in our organization are from the Bay Area, and they have a few investments, beautiful, you know, historic type buildings here in Portland. And I mean, your question is a really good one in terms of, you know, how have they dealt with that? But I do think it's a whole different set of dynamics that, you know, lending criteria and, you know, California is just much more clued into it.
Well, I know we offer like historic building tax abatements. What about just a straightforward 100% property tax abatement with those proceeds going into retrofit? What would that look like?
I think for some owners that would look lovely. That would be an incredible asset.
A huge help. You have to kind of pencil out, you know, the cost of the outright versus the property taxes, but that would be enormous. And that would be direct that, you know, certainly would benefit.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. We have a lot of city folks here. Has anybody ever looked at that? 1,200 to 1,300 buildings, total property tax abatement. What the impact would that be on city coffers, county coffers, school district coffers? That's, you don't need to answer that now, but I guess I'd like to see that number.
Yeah, it's not as crazy as it sounds, and I don't mean that as a criticism. In another sense, in that, again, values are rising overall, AV is rising overall, compression is still a problem, but less so, and under the formulation that council is now working under, we're going to be putting more value back on the tax rolls at, you know, starting in July 1 and more later, that was in URAs. So the ability to take a tranche of property tax revenue and assessed value and defer public collections is maybe greater than it was in a recession and with right up against the ceiling of urban renewal areas. So, I think that's a tool we ought to explore, because what's compared to the cost of cleanup and losing the buildings and loss of life and everything else, it's cheap, right, to defer or to forego collecting property taxes if the result is a building that's still there paying property taxes for another 100 years, just like it's reasonable to forego collecting taxes from new development in order to get the apartment building in the first place or to get the redevelopment in a URA. So the principle's the same to me.
We'd have to see where they are, though. If they're already in an urban renewal district, we're not getting property taxes.
Right,
right.
PDC is.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So that's why they've got to be at the table for that reason as well.
And there was and the special assessment tool, I think, essentially was that. And over time, the special assessment tool has been reduced. When I first started working at PDC, it was a program where there was a 15-year special assessment, and most property owners could get a second 15-year special assessment. Over time, I think it's now just 10 years, and I think it's harder to get the second 10 years. I think what has been amazing is whether it's been the Prickers or Restore Oregon, a nonprofit, very much concerned about this particular issue, or others, or all the recommendations that came this morning. There are a lot of recommendations out there, and there are absolutely lessons learned from everywhere else. I think we all have to work together to consolidate all those recommendations and figure out what's going to work in Oregon, what's different, what's the same. You know, one of the things that I think we have to take into consideration, in both Seattle and the Bay Area or Los Angeles, our rents are a lot higher there. And so I the economic dynamics are definitely different. I think when Gwen Baldwin talks about having a variety of tools, we want to make sure that they're accessible. So one of the things that we think about with all of this is not only educating the market for the need, but also educating the market about how to use these variety of tools. You know, when you're throwing six or seven different tools at a particular project, it becomes very complex. And that was one of the major points I wanted to get across. And so that needs help in helping people understand and foster their way through all using all these different tools and what makes the most sense in any particular situation.
There's also a variety of city-owned properties within that inventory of URMs, whether it's Park Bureau properties, VES properties. Everybody has something in that pool that's there, that's whether it's any of the bureaus as well as the Portland Public Schools. And of course, that tax break is not going to be the tool that fits them well. So we do need another avenue for that to occur. And we're hopeful that as Portland Public Schools moves forward with the bond measures and we get some of these buildings redone that are significant and have a risk associated with them that's fairly high, that we'll see, you know, those will drop out of that inventory as well, and we'll see improvements all across the city. But again, that 1,200 number or 1,300 number does include city buildings as well.
On urban renewal areas, I mean, I don't know how many of these buildings are housing people like below 60% of median family income, but I'm curious, Commissioner Salzman, in terms of the 30% set aside, can that only be used for building new affordable housing, or could it be used for ensuring that existing affordable housing continues to exist?
It can be used to preserve existing affordable housing.
Yeah. I mean,
as well.
Commissioner Novick, most of the buildings in Old Town Chinatown that house affordable housing that are unreinforced masonry have been improved. I can think of two that have not, and they're on the Portland Housing Bureau's list. Yeah, but every other building, if you think of the Estate Hotel, you think of Musolf Manor, you think of Sally McCracken, all of these buildings have been seismically upgraded.
Is it a wacky idea to suggest that one option might be to take some of these existing buildings that right now, do not house only affordable housing people, and say that, you know, if you can do that, then we would pay for the seismic upgrades or help pay for them?
I'm trying to understand the question. Can you say that again?
Well, let's say you've got an unreinforced masonry building now, which houses people, okay, but not exclusively low-income people.
Right.
Is it a wacky idea to suggest that you might sort of make a deal with them saying, if you can house exclusively low-income people, then we can pay for the seismic upgrades?
Or at
least partly. Early, yeah.
All wacky ideas need to be on the table.
I guess the only thing I would say is if an owner has a building and it's filled with tenants, do we really want to be in a position of having that owner be faced with a mechanism for seismic upgrading or evicting an apartment building to switch it out to affordable housing?
If you did it like you described for Trinity Place, if it was as people leave, then the apartment gets, so it wouldn't necessarily switch all over to affordable housing, but there could be, you know, like a 30% or something requirement.
And then you've got the issue of whether or not those rents are, you know, are market rate. If they were market rate, what's the mechanism for the city ongoing in terms of paying for them ongoing? I mean, that, it just, it, yes, I mean, that can be absolutely part of the mix, but I think if we swap out one issue for another in terms of having things financially pencil, then it just makes it more complicated.
But well, it looks like we might need a whole slew of things, so that might be one of the options. Yeah. I just wanted to mention that I met with that Heritage Brokers group way earlier in the year, and I have this very helpful memo, which I will pass on to you, that Gwen sent me as far as potential constituents for a community advisory committee. Appreciate very much your help.
Great. So you two have been very helpful there.
So I guess, you know, my question is, this is a very important issue, and it seems like it would be most appropriate for Commissioner Novick and Commissioner Fritz to be taking the lead on bringing forward recommendations for us to consider, to do something. And that could include, you know, closing existing trigger loopholes to, you know, from as far as I'm concerned, everything's on the table. Am I correct in that assessment that you two are going to be taking the lead on this, or is it Commissioner Novick? But
I'm not.
Okay, then I guess it's Commissioner Novick.
My staff will certainly be helping.
Okay. Well, Commissioner Novick, then, are you taking the lead
on this? Yes, although despite her disclaiming the lead, I was expecting to be in close consultation with Commissioner Fritz. But yes, I mean, we are planning to develop some specific proposals. We thought that it was helpful for the whole council to hear this description of the problem at this point.
And very helpful. And Steve, if you're willing to take the lead, obviously each of us has bureaus that are going to have to engage in the process. I do in both planning and PDC as well. So call on us and our bureaus, and obviously on folks in the community, like the Brickers Group, who have expertise and a stake in making this work. It's going to be a set of solutions. It's going to be, you know, we need to look at regulatory things, but I think the point's been well made here that you can't just solve this problem with regulation. It's going to take financing tools that we already have or can use, like tax abatement, and it might take completely new mechanisms like some kind of insurance pool scheme that I would half understand, even if I could describe it better than I am now. But that's what those folks do, and I think we need to engage the insurance and banking folks as well to help us figure this out. You know, I spent 10 years in the transit industry, and in the rest of the world, they use very robust public-private partnerships to finance new transportation projects. And in this country, we've never really figured that out. Neither our financial industry nor our transit agencies have ever gotten that to scale. In fact, one of the few examples that anybody's ever done is our airport light rail project. But in the rest of the world, there are financing organizations, there are banks and financial houses that know how to do stuff that we don't typically do. And my sense is, in this issue, that may be the case. Not necessarily elsewhere in the world, but maybe in California, there might be banks and insurance companies that have already gotten to the next level of sophistication that we want to learn from. So that's why I keep going to that notion, is that seems to me, as somebody who actually pays a premium for earthquake insurance, it seems to me that there ought to be a way to get that slice of additional cost monetized into the ability to finance projects, at least partially. So that would be somebody else that I think that maybe with your help we can access some of those folks. I assume that
happy
we can
help.
Call on your group to, as you have already suggested, to provide people and participation in this effort. So.
Absolutely. It's an ongoing partnership.
Good.
Thank you.
Well, Commissioner Novick and Carmen, thank you for pulling this together. Really, really thoughtful discussion and big issue and big challenge for us. Those photos of Christchurch, to me, I knew about the earthquake in Christchurch, but just seeing that aerial photo of what they lost, and not to mention the loss of life, that's literally the view that we don't want to see. So this is important work and timely, and we appreciate you and your team putting together a good briefing for us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.